This episode of the Popcast is brought to you by these sponsors.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Popcast. I have a special treat for you today. Alliances. Like, a lot of people are like, oh, what are they? Like, whatever. I have one of the best. One of the best in the world. This is Nima Beatty. He's the global VP of alliances at GitLab. Welcome to the Popcast.
And great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So the Popcast is, you know, if you've watched it, the idea of this is like, I want to hear about your journey, like all the way to getting to GitLab, first time on computer, like, hey, I like this. I want to do alliances or whatever, wherever we got to. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, no, this is really funny because we just had an offsite with my team and we talked a little bit about career building and what your career is going to look like. It's never a straight line up and to the right. It's going to be this weird squiggly line. You're going to go backwards. You're going to go sideways. So I always start up telling people I started my career working at the age of 13, digging ditches for my father's construction firm because I was hands-on, you're low-skilled labor, but it's a great way to earn money. First, you earn money for, you know, gas money or whatever you want to do in terms of your summer off, back when those days when we had precious summers off.
Neil, where'd you grow up, if you don't mind me asking?
So I grew up in Southern California in Los Angeles. And it was kind of a great time to be there. But again, I was an engineer or tradesman or craftsman at heart, and I love to build things and take things apart with my hands. Really curious nature. But you know, you don't go to college thinking, I want to major in alliances. Like, there's no such thing on alliances. There's not even a book on how to do alliances properly. And I think it's kind of a part of a dark art that most people don't study by virtue of getting a proper book education, but one that's more experiential. So when I talk to people about what was your journey, my journey was, construction to pay for college. And then after college, grad school, I'd spend a summer building airplanes at Boeing. And then I went and built computers that's on microsystems. And I went back to school to get an MBA. And for a brief time, I built PowerPoint decks at Deloitte. And then I refollowed my heart back into technology and kind of started at the bottom rung where in my mid 30s, I'm competing with 20-year-olds, but I wanted a career in tech and I really loved that. And I went back to being a product manager, first at a couple of different social media companies, but then by virtue of just building out a network and getting to know people, you know, stopped getting into that sort of cycle of applying for jobs. And then we're just kind of introduced to people who are looking for a particular skill set or a particular person to take on a job. And nearly every job I have had, I hadn't done it before. And so people were willing to take a risk on you and say, you know, you seem pretty smart. I think you can get it. I'm going to hire you for the company, not the role, because I think you'll grow into it. And I keep seeing a lot of people posting about that, saying, you know, hire for the company, hire for cultural, hire for empathy. The ability, the skill set required to do this job will actually come very quickly and very naturally. So about 10, 12 years ago, I was—
Can we talk about that real quick? I'm going to interrupt you for a second.
No, I'll talk about it as in the context of Pivotal, where, you know, what I had learned on my own kind of became codified into a way that one company does business. So,
but I want to talk about the networking aspect, Nima. I want to double click on that one because the networking aspect is to like somebody listening to this right now. You're a pro at this. This is what you need to do technical alliance as well. You need to be able to network. Give like the listeners and the watchers here, like what is Nima's like, here's the things, the recipe for this.
So I will borrow a page out of someone who's been a huge mentor to me, a gentleman named James Waters, who's now the CTO at VMware for the Tanzu cloud application platform. And so he was my boss when I was at VMware. And he literally, he took a risk on me because I came in with a reference from a gentleman named Jason Hoffman, who was the CTO and founder of Joyent. And at the time, Jason had taken a risk on me and said, you know, you're a product manager. Have you ever done marketing before? I said, not really, but I can figure it out. And he gave me a job doing product and partner marketing. And that kind of blossomed into other things. But to get back to kind of what James taught me, he said, in your career, there is an inflection point. For the majority of your career, your network is all about who you know. And then there's a tipping point, and then it becomes about who knows you. And everything before and after that zenith will change. So before that, it's really about you have a brand, you have a personal skill set, you have perishable knowledge, you continue to invest in that knowledge. You have an internal network that's built inside of your company of other people who help you do your job better. But then you start growing your network outside of the company, other people who look like you, other people in sister industries or partners or customers. You grow that, you grow that, you grow that. And at some point when you tip over, your engagement with individuals becomes different. Like you're no longer the one who hunts, but the one who people come to. And then you become more of a brand ambassador, right? It's more about your thought leadership. It's more about you investing in your growth networks. And this is where you actually start elevating your network. No longer are you meeting with other people who are at the same level as you, but now you're connecting with VPs, with CEOs, with CTOs, with founders, and also in tangential areas. Like if you're in technology, you'll actually connect with VCs or connect with bankers. You'll connect with entrepreneurs and organizations that support those types of people, partly because these are supportive of your network. Like, for example, after I had joined VMware, we got carved out to be Pivotal. I would routinely, you know, go up and down Sand Hill Road and meet with venture capitalists, not because I was pitching a product, because I was really interested in the portfolio of companies that they had invested in. And I was looking for partners who are at the right stage and provided the right level of services and technology and capabilities that could append and add value to what we were doing at Pivotal. And at the time, Pivotal was a small fledgling 1,200 person company. We had just been started. We certainly didn't have enough resources, enough money, or enough engineers to build all the things we wanted to, but we could find partners that had products that were mature enough and new enough and comported to the whole idea of cloud native architectures that we could sister with, and we could do a great co-sell or meet in the market motion together, or even do something a little bit more sophisticated than that. And that's really where it started. Then you start going to conferences and you get to start meeting people within conferences and you start collecting conference badges. And at one point I used to have all my conference badges hanging on a hook, and the coat hanger literally fell over because it was so heavy, and I still have it somewhere. If we put them all on, you look like Mr. T from the A-Team, right?
It's just, right here, we'll have a graphic of Mr. T here.
Exactly. Okay. And it's great because that's the investment you have to make. And we talk about, this is a job that you can't, there's no acceleration curve for it, right? There's no equivalent to a time and seat. You have to invest the time and effort required to build your network, to build your confidence, to build that capability, that skill set, that awareness, right? It takes time, and it's just, there's no way to accelerate it. And so someone doing alliances at the age of 20, it's a great time to start, but think about how much more mature you'll be in your 30s or in your 40s or even in your 50s. And the world of experience that you have seen is so much more valuable from someone who's a little bit more senior, a little bit more experienced. So for a lot of people who I say are getting into this job, my recommendation is just kind of build your brand, build your skill set and your knowledge, be curious about everything, but also appreciate that it just takes time. There's only so many hours in the day. There's only so many people you can meet in a given day. And there's so many experiences you can possibly fit into a year. You can't inorganically force it. That's been helpful. It's a test of patience, and not a lot of people have the patience to do it. Good partnerships don't happen overnight. It's this kind of continued investment in growth and personal development that helps you build proper, stable relationships. And those are the ones that you keep with you, because that person that sits across from you, for example, from Sysdig that we're speaking with, they may go on to a different job later on. They're going to have a positive experience with what they did with GitLab and maybe potentially me or somebody else. And remember that experience and then take it to the next job, and I'll take it to my next job. And that quickly you bring all of these great relationships with you and grow these very important connective tissue in all of your relationships. And I think that, again, takes time for you to build a competence, for you to build even a reliable brand around yourself, around like, who is this guy Nima? What does he do? Do I know him? Does he know me? And what can he do for me? To something that is akin to more of a conversation with the person across the table from you or sitting next to you, as opposed to being an adversarial relationship, which is really not what you want. Partnerships are additive. 1 + 1 is more than 2. But it takes a while for two parties to figure out that narrative. And you've got to be open to just exploring to get to that point so you can have that better together story. So sorry, it was kind of a run-on answer to your question, but mostly
again, these are things, if somebody's listening to this right now, they know like these are the things that they're gonna have to like, you know, put together from their career perspective to go to the next level. And by the way, shout out to James Waters, good, really great guy. Actually, I'm actually obligated to say Tanzu. because that's what I need to do. It's a good,
yeah, James is fantastic.
Yeah.
In part of I think what makes James really special is that he surrounds himself by incredibly smart and capable people. And so that rising tide really lifts all boats and allows you to not only learn more. I mean, I've learned a ton just sitting in the room, listening to the way that that James would pitch, that James would talk to people. He was very inclusive. When he spoke, people would listen. And that kind of gravitas takes a while to cultivate, but he did it like it was drinking water. It was just native capability for him.
Wonderful, wonderful guy. Like I said, yeah, I've had absolutely. So many great interactions with him. And exactly like you said, I mean, he draws people to the speed, you know, the way he speaks, and also he makes people feel part of the solution in the room. It's a rare art, and he's one of the best in the world at it.
Do you want to give developers an internal platform to enable self-service and application observability, freeing you to focus on implementing application policies and scaling infrastructure? That's exactly what Shipper delivers. All you need to get started, land a win with your developers, and save your time is a namespace. Take an online tour at onboarding.novadic.com. That's onboarding.novadic.com.
GitLab is the DevOps platform. Deliver software faster with better security and collaboration in a single platform. Try GitLab today. Go to https://about.gitlab.com/free trial. That's https://about.gitlab.com/free-trial. Check them out.
Let me ask you this. I'm going to ask you this question. So again, you talk about partnerships and talk about these things. What are good partnerships and alliances? And then conversely, what are bad? Or ones that don't work as well?
So I'll start off with kind of this answer. Assume all partnerships in the beginning are bad. Right? It's kind of like ideation. Ideation takes on the philosophy that you don't have the right answer, that over time with small incremental changes, you'll be less and less and less wrong. And really good partnerships kind of start off with that premise. You're not going to be able to eat the whole whale on your first deal. You're going to have to find an in with a partner where you provide a value that is greater to them than the value that they perceive they provide to you. So for them, they believe that it's net positive in their direction. And so you're going to have to spend some time to figure out, well, what's important to them? Is it time to market? Is it a capability? Is it reach? Is it network? Is it price competitiveness, feature parity? Is it competitive intelligence? There's a lot of different variables that start off a good relationship. And then what you need to do over the time is once you've inked that relationship, that's not the finish line, right? That's the start line. They need to work together to figure out at what point and what motion does it make sense for us always to participate? And that's really tricky to figure out. It's not obvious because a lot of companies and technology, especially in our sector, we tend to have sometimes, you know, similar feature sets. Sometimes we're slightly competitive with each other and there's a bit of a Venn diagram overlap. You have to get over that, right? Just accept that there's some things you do really well, some things I do really well. Maybe together, what we can do is solve a customer problem, because more likely than not, we have mutual customers and they're likely going to take a look at both of us and say, well, I need both of these two things. I need Sysdig and GitLab, but now they're stuck. How do I make the two work together? Oh boy, that's a burden I don't want to have as a customer. What if we get together and we figure that out for them and we present an intact idea that out of the box, this is how Sysdig works really well with GitLab. This is the service that adds value on top of GitLab. These are the capabilities that now a Sysdig user can expand with GitLab in terms of a DevOps portfolio. And you start to really think through from a customer's perspective, how do I solve customer problems that I may not necessarily understand, but have empathy for? How do I exhibit this ability to showcase that I understand my customers' needs and that my customers' needs do not have a direct correlation with my product or your product? It's really somewhere in between or a combination thereof. So when we all got to Pivotal, we were introduced to this idea of scoring for empathy as part of the recruitment process. So whenever we would actually interview candidates, one of the rubrics that we used was empathy. And I delightfully, when I left Pivotal and joined Google, this was a big part of Google's recruitment tactic and interview process. They were really looking for people who had empathy, and they couched it under this term of googliness.
Can we talk about this, just empathy in general? Like, what is this definition of? Everybody has their definition of what empathy is. Like, you know what I mean? But we're like, what would you say? What is your definition of what empathy is?
You know, it means different things to other people, but I think at its base, it's just, can I see it from your perspective? That's it. Even if I don't agree with you, can I just see it from your perspective? If I can see it from your perspective, I can then understand how to, like, for example, if you're in a negotiation, empathy is really important to you because you can understand the opposing party's, defensive points, their defensive arguments, their particular position. And if you're in the legal profession, it's incredibly helpful for you. While they tell you in a court of law, you need to have an adversarial position, empathy actually is really, really important skill set for you in any job market, in any role that you have. But in particular with alliances, half of our job is just understanding the other party, understanding how our customers would use A and B together, understanding how my partner views me, how I should view my partner, how we can, figure out if there's actual middle ground where we can work together. And a lot of these partnerships, they really do take time to matriculate. Like, right, we have partnerships that might take 3 years to matriculate. Think of, large technology companies that they're just kind of set in their ways. They have a particular way of working, and they may not adopt new technology as quickly as you would like them to. But over time, they will definitely grok the value of something new and something innovative, a different approach. Same thing with customers, right? Most of the dot-com startups tend to adopt cool new technologies very quickly. They grok it, but larger companies, especially in financial services or banking or insurance, medical, manufacturing, energy, these sectors, they look on these smaller, nimbler startups and say, I would like to achieve that. I'd like to be able to do that, but I have an organization that has a lot of momentum that's difficult to change overnight. Now, how can
it's I like be moving a battleship? You've heard that analogy 1,000 times, right? Like moving a battleship is much more difficult than taking like a speedboat and making that change. It's
exactly.
I got to be honest with you. It's why I don't go to larger companies. I've gotten these offers all the time. It's like smaller companies to me are much more nimble, right? That's number one. And number two, like you can react with the times much more quickly. It's just like open source, right? Open source is amazing because you can change courses so quickly. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
And that's one of the things that kind of is the great democracy, kind of a democratization of software is open source is a chance for pretty much everybody to have equal voice. And it's a true meritocracy. So, In the case of let's say Falco, for example, from Sysdig, right? I think Sysdig saw a very relevant need within the Cloud Foundry, the CNCF, the Cloud Native Ecosystem, and identified, yes, we'd like to build a product, but the first step to building a product is to in a community like CNCF is to get consensus. So if we could get consensus on a design pattern, on a framework that could solve this problem, then we could actually build products and services and monetize on top of that. And I think the Falco approach was really great. And one of the rubrics that tells you this is working is when other people start adopting Falco as the underlying technology for solving a specific problem.
GitLab is again one of our huge adopters of Falco. And again, I'm very proud. I'm the community manager for Falco. Everyone, sorry, I took my podcast hat off and put that on. But the way that I look at it is we are community based, but exactly like you said, it's been adopted, for things like Threat Hunter, for instance, for GitLab. Because it's an underlying basis and it is the de facto runtime, tool for runtime detection on Kubernetes. The way my analogy has always been what Kubernetes is, the distributed computing. I feel that Falco is for runtime security. If something's happening in your environment, you'll be able to see it very, very quickly. And again, like you said, the telltale sign is other companies adopting it. When we did the CNEBPF day at KubeCon, seeing Apple using Falco and speaking so highly of it. Literally, I was so touched, but also all I saw all these community members, like folks from GitLab, like folks from, you know, AWS, like IBM, all Sysflow, all these people that are contributing, that they're doing these things. It's exactly like you said. It's this true meritocracy where people come in, they feel part of this. They feel part of the growth of Falco.
Yeah. So. And that's kind of, that's really important, because in the open source, you want to be able to collaborate and share ideas and let the best ideas matriculate into whatever becomes what's post-incubation in CNCFD, you say. So I don't know what they call it.
Core. It's graduation. It's graduate project. Yeah.
So it's been great to see that. But at the same time, like from our perspective, GitLab, the problem that we're trying to solve is we consider ourselves a platform. So a platform should technically come with all the batteries included. And we want that first getting started experience to be profound for the customer, to delight the customer, so that they say, this is exactly what I needed to solve all my problems. Now, will it have all the features and all the capabilities that every single customer in the world wants? Probably not. They're going to customize it for their unique environments, but you want to give them exactly everything they need just to get started. And a lot of platform players and customers, and this actually happened with Cloud Foundry back when I was at Pivotal, was we had the added responsibility of considering the customer's needs and then choosing certain technologies and embedding that or including that in their overall getting started experience. So for example, and I'll go back to Cloud Foundry just to use that as an analogy, we were initially very enamored with, I think it was Andy Wiggins's 12-factor app model, right? And so that's brilliant. That model actually explains and architects roadmaps a much cleaner way of building applications. And there are some simple rule sets. We looked at Heroku and we said, the build pack model is fantastic because now all the environment variables and everything I need to compile an application into a specific runtime is available for me as a service. And all I need to do is just upload my app and it can auto detect and build all the libraries and dependencies I need. Shannon Cohn, who's the product manager at Pivotal, was kind of on the forefront of creating the service brokers, said, hey, what if applications can actually have one-to-one, one-to-many relationships with add-on services that are provided outside of the platform layer, outside of the PaaS? How do we describe that? Well, that's for how service brokers were born. So all these great ideas were kind of born in and they were included as part of the overall Cloud Foundry package. So when you bought Cloud Foundry from Pivotal, it all just worked. You didn't really need anything additional. And then you could then customize it for your own environment, own needs, or just the way you worked. And I think the platform provided have this unique responsibility of helping customers curate what they think they will at least need. Now, most platforms are, you know, interchangeable, meaning modules can be replaced with something that's much more sophisticated. Technology does move. Like, for example, when I was at Google on Anthos, the SCN started out being, I think it was Calico by Tigera, but eventually moved to eBPF. That was a kind of a normal graduation. As better technology emerges, the platform provider's responsibility is to replace the technologies, but make it seamless to the end customer. And customer doesn't have to do anything differently now. So in that guise, it's refreshing to see companies that are developing and promoting these kind of early technologies really promote and participate with platform providers to help them better understand, well, this is how Falco should be included in these five or six different platform.
That's something GitLab does so well. It rolls with it. I mean, again, I think there's things you all do with, like, you know, policies, but adoption of, like, not only Falco, there's adoption of all these underlying things that make it better to use, you know, your commercial aspects there. I mean, you all do that extremely well and extremely quickly. And it's almost like they adopt, like you said, like you see things like Anthos, where initially it was Tigera and they moved over to Cilium, for instance, from the eBPF perspective. But it was also like with you all, I love the fact that you all very much drink your own, you know, apple juice or whatever it might be, right? You all like, look, this is fantastic. We're going to try to adopt this and then we're going to put it in there, and it makes everything even better. But your ears are always out there. And also, like, you adopt this very, you know, Git centric way. Like, you have your principles, like everybody can see GitLab's, you know, principles out there. Cause I had Brandon O'Leary on a couple of weeks ago during KubeCon, their week before KubeCon. And he talked about those principles. I'm going to ask you this. I want to go off the reservation.
No, please.
Go back here. I'm going to ask you this, like the culture at GitLab. I want you to, you know, you've been in a you know, companies, a bunch of companies in your group. I want to talk to me about how it seems like everybody who works at GitLab just loves being there. Talk to me about that culture of GitLab culture.
I've only been here less than a year. I will parrot that sentiment very strongly. I think every company I have gone to has exhibited an even stronger set of cultural values that benefit the mass, like all the employees, all the investors as a whole. And let me back up and explain what I mean by that. I think what's unique about GitLab is, to the public, we took this remote first attitude, and they see it as, oh, well, they're 100% remote company, so that must be something that's akin to the way that they work. But if you peel just a layer of the onion back, what we're really saying is we want you to be productive in the environment that you feel the most comfortable. And so you're going to have people who are, they work asynchronously. They like to work on their own time. They like to work in their own environment where they're comfortable, and they can really be producers. And these are the makers of the world who may not necessarily feel comfortable being in a hyper-socially interactive environment. And I say this because when we were at Pivotal, you know, the engineering teams had to pair. And when we came over from VMware, there were definitely some engineers who expressed a tremendous amount of anxiety having to physically pair with another individual. What? Two keyboards, two laptops, one machine? I don't feel comfortable sitting that closely to another person. I don't feel comfortable sharing my ideas and my code. I feel exposed. But the benefit of that was, before anybody wrote anything down or typed anything up or actually hands on keyboards, we would talk about it. Hey, is this the right approach? How should we fix this problem? How do we solve this kind of difficult challenge that's in front of us? And that made the quality of the code so much better. So overall, it was the right thing to do. Within GitLab, it's really about working the way, or giving the employees a way and the opportunity to work how they are the most comfortable. So if you're at home and you're asynchronous and you just want to be on Slack and just do your work, you can do that. If you're like me and you love being on Zoom and synchronous and dealing with people, you can do that too. And so it gives you the environment that allows you to be the most productive. You know, the nice thing is I now save, you know, 2 hours of my life not having to commute and clog up the freeways and basically being in an environment where I'm just, you know, in a car, you're not productive. I don't feel comfortable doing calls because I can't pay attention. I can't write. So that was kind of dead space for me. But now I get that all back and I'm a lot more productive, which means that I can spend more time with my family. I can, you know, stop working at 6 o'clock and go work out or go make dinner or you know, help my kid with his homework. That all really helps out. And once you're able to curate that environment, then the collaboration comes out naturally. The tool itself, GitLab, is really designed for collaboration. We kind of talk about our mission statement is really everyone can contribute. And we really do mean that. And I think part of the scary part, I should say, is most people think of Git as like some sort of black art science that only developers know. Oh, you know, you have to do everything in a terminal shell. You have to have these Git commands. Well, the reality is no. You can work that way or you can work in the browser. And this idea of anybody can suggest a change and a set of editors are permitted to review the change and approve or deny the change has been around for 20 years. We used to call it Wikipedia, right? So people would write content, someone would edit it, it would get approved and then updated and improved over time. Well, that's how code works. Now, if you operate that way, all of your documentation can be created and developed and improved that way. Now we get into more sophisticated tranches with things like Kubernetes and network configuration infrastructure. Well, I can, for example, put all my GitOps configurations within code and curate and update this exactly the same way as I do with code or with documentation. All of a sudden, we have a shared philosophy of working together. Everything is transparent. It's auditable. It's reviewed. We have an audit trail of who made the change, why the change was made. We have a lot more transparency in the code. And better yet, everything that's configurable can be stored in a single location. So my firewall rule sets aren't in a flat text file on the firewall. My security settings aren't in some configurable proprietary system over there in the corner that only one person has access to.
My policies, my rules, everything. Exactly. It's a standardization. Everything is here in one place. And again, the enabler, GitLab. And also, here's the reality, financials, right? I mean, this has been, you know, financials, federal, you know, agencies, all those, it's super, super hard to do that on some type of public Git. And you hear these software supply chain issues, and we're not going to go into that, but there's been enough of that. You know, if you want to, you know, honestly, if you want to see a great thing, I'll put a link in the thing. Brendan O'Leary did a great blog about software supply chain. Again, plug, not, it's just an awesome thing, but I want to ask you this. Look, I'm going to go back to the alliances question in general. It's like, look, there's people like listening to this are like, you know, oh, it's just, you know, I go talk to this software company and whatever. There's so many nuance to alliances. There's, you know, there's software alliances, ISV partners. There's, you know, like hyperscale cloud providers. There's the channel. Can you kind of give like that elevator of the different types of like just overall alliances that you can have in a company?
Yeah, I mean, look, the principal role of anybody within alliances is to build a bridge, right? That's really what we do. We build bridges between islands that did not previously have connectivity. And so I'll kind of walk into kind of how you get into this. So what is alliances? Alliances is basically a relationship between two entities, your company and another company. And you'll hear it couched in channels versus alliances. Now, channels historically has been very much a sales motion. It's really the extraordinary arm of a sales organization where sales has direct sellers, you know, these are briefcase carrying individuals who sell directly to end customers. Channels tend to be more like an agent broker model. There are other entities out there who are selling agencies that we can engage. And we can get a one-to-end relationship through them as opposed to a one-to-one relationship with direct selling. Channels is an extraordinary ability for a company, especially a growing company, to have a 10x return on their sales investment. It's a great way to just scale up without having to scale every infrastructure resource you have within the sales organization. Alliances typically fall sometimes within the sales organization, sometimes within product, sometimes within strategy or CTO. Really depends on the company you talk to. But these are relationships where basically three different things happen. One is solution completeness. We partner with a company that adds something that our product is missing that we think customers are going to want, right? Maybe we don't do monitoring. We can work with a Datadog to provide that monitoring layer. Maybe we don't provide a specific area of security. Maybe we can work with Sysdig to provide that as an add-on. Then that way the customers have that option of, like, if I need this extra security, I can buy it from Sysdig. The second is to partner with what we call traditionally platform providers. A platform provider is like a Red Hat with OpenShift or VMware with ESX and Tanzu, where this is where companies run their applications, run their application estates, run their entire application portfolio on top of. And the reason these types of partnerships are important is because, for one thing, as an alliance manager, that's a captive audience. They have a whole bunch of customers all on one platform. So if my stuff works with their platform, technically I have access to all those customers who also run on top of that platform. And then the third type of alliance partnerships are the hyperscalers. And these are basically platforms to the nth degree with exponential growth capacity. The hyperscalers like Amazon, Microsoft, Google, AliCloud, as well as the two true clouds behind them, they're on the vanguard of this kind of next generation motion that's happening, where we've gone from the 1800s of let me produce my own electricity to a utility model. I've gone through let me buy my own expensive Sun servers and have my own data center to I'll let that be managed by a managed service provider to actually, you know what, the rate of innovation from these hyperscalers is so much faster than I could have ever hoped for. That I don't even have to pay for software anymore. Everything is as a consumable service. I just pay for what I need, and I don't pay for any of this extra stuff. I don't have to worry about installing software anymore. I don't have to worry about uptime of services. This is fantastic. It's a true utilitarian model. And I think a lot of big businesses are slowly getting to the point where they're comfortable with that idea, right? The SLO, SLA guarantees are superior coming from the hyperscalers. The uptime is better. The quality of the services, the rate of innovation, and the lowering cost of these services is at the point where it's just a lot better, more attractive if I actually go that route. Now, a lot of companies will stay on-prem, or they will at least leave a part of their estate on-prem because it's very expensive to move. or the underlying technology isn't really cloud native, or they just don't have the resources to move it over. But at some point, that inflection curve will happen, and it'll just be much more organic and natural for us to actually start in the clouds. Born in the cloud mentality will happen. All Fortune 10,000 companies probably have designs and aspirations to be all cloud native, but they're faced with the reality of they have a lot of inventory, of catalog of stuff that they currently run in different areas they couldn't possibly migrate over. So it might just make more sense to leave them where they are, but then adopt these new cloud native methodologies for the next generation of applications. And they're probably growing their application footprint at a rate of doubling it every 5 years. So within a couple of years, even a decade, the proportion that's on-prem, still on mainframes, still on legacy systems, will just be diminishing over time. And the bulk will actually be running on the clouds. So these are the three types of relationships we look for, where GitLab can materially facilitate the adoption and migration of customers to these platforms, as well as their productivity on those platforms themselves. So if I'm let's say I'm Ford Motor Company, right? Most of us think of Ford as an automobile manufacturer. I think of them as a software company that just tends to bend sheet metal and slap four tires on it. The Ford F-150 of a couple of years ago has 150 million lines of code. So at some point, we're going to realize that Marc Andreessen's vision of software is eating the world has been realized, because every company, in order to survive the next 15 years, is fundamentally going to have to resolve that they are, in fact, a software company. And software is a core competence. So whether you're providing insurance or banking services or medical services or energy, everything is now built in software. If you're a manufacturer of oil and gas, you're using software. You're building software. You're creating value to end customers through software. And we see this everywhere. Like, nothing has been untouched by it. And so the ability to have a software competence, to have the tool sets that allow you to be much more productive with the limited resources that you have, to get ideas through the ideation funnel, through development, through testing pipeline, validation, certification, and out to your cloud of choice, your deployment target of choice, is going to be super critical. And so we used to talk about the day in the life of a developer as being basically an 8-hour day, where you start your day having an inception with your team, a stand-up where you share a couple of ideas. You capture those ideas as user stories or feature sets in your planning tool. Then you pull from the planning tool your backlog, you develop it, you store it in your source code repository, you work with it through IDE. And then sometime around 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, just before you're about to leave, you do your merge request, your pull request, and your job is done, but then all the automated systems, their intake over, and then they build and compile and test, validate and deploy your software image. And so you have, in an 8-hour period, a tremendous amount of productivity, because you just did something new that didn't exist that morning. And you can see as you're walking out the door, the fruits of your labor, because hopefully on the radiators, your compilation tests are all green, your pipeline tests are all green, and it means it's already deployed into production. That would be the ideal scenario for any developer. I think every developer in the world would love to live in that utopia. We're not all there yet, but slowly and surely we will get there.
With tools like GitLab again. GitLab, you see here?
GitLab.
What if you could build like big tech? Use the same powerful infrastructure that they spent engineering centuries building. It's actually possible now with CockroachDB. The founders have spent the last 8 years creating a cloud-native distributed SQL database that provides the consistency, ultra resilience, data locality, and a massive scale for modern cloud applications, tech that was once only available to the likes of Google, Facebook, and Netflix. Check them out and get started for free at cockroachlabs.com/popcast. That's cockroachlabs.com/popcast. Check them out. Sivo is an alternative to the big hyperscale cloud providers. They've launched the world's first managed Kubernetes service powered exclusively by K3S. With sub-90-second cluster launch times, a simplified Kubernetes experience, and predictable billing, Siebel is on a mission to create a better developer experience. Get $250 free credit to get started. Sign up today at sievocloud.com/popcast. That's CIVO.com/POPCAST. Go check them out.
You know, it helps you get there. But listen, I'm going to ask you this question. This is airing during a reInvent week, right? This is, let's talk about reInvent as a place, you know, and large events in general, like for building alliances, you know, like I think, again, it's like the pandemic was really difficult for you to have these face-to-face kind of conversations about, wow, it's cool what you're doing. I'm doing something cool. Maybe we can do something cool together, right? So talk to me about like these events as a place to garner new alliance partners.
So one of the things I loved about reInvent was actually the expo floor. I almost, in the last 8 years I've gone, I hardly get to make it to any of the sessions because most of my time is spent on the floor or in one of the little niche coffee shops that are around there, just connecting with people. I think what Amazon has done exceptionally well as a hyperscale, as a cloud provider, as a cloud partner, is they have become the center of gravity for all things cloud related, almost like the CES of cloud. And so by virtue of pulling all these people in, you really only have to go to 2 or 3 or 4 events per year to hit the majority of the companies you want to work with. So if you're an independent ISV shop, you're building something, you can quickly pair with other similar companies in your space, build a relationship, build a life by just going to reInvent. You can also build the relationships with your Amazon partners there and build your capabilities on the kind of the growing subset of all the services that Amazon provides. And I think at the last count, Amazon had over 160 plus services. That's phenomenal. So if I'm an ISV, not only can I build something that is of value that can run on top of Amazon, that is now consumable Amazon customers, I'm adding something that Amazon doesn't have, but I can actually run my entire business on top of Amazon itself. I can just be born in the cloud. They have a great, fantastic set of services through SaaS Factory and all their application migration services and all the consulting partners that they have. And they make it really easy for you to just build on them and not have to really concern yourself with some of the lower level infrastructure management and orchestration issues. I can build applications that basically interact with Amazon completely through an API. And so all of my guarantees, all of my contracts with Amazon are going to be software contracts through an API. And I know that they're not going to change that much because in most cases, if you publish an API, your intent is not to deprecate that API. It's to append on top of it and keep improving it, because you want stability. That's the one interface you're exposing to the world. You can rebuild and refactor your entire product behind the scenes, but your APIs will always remain stable. And when Jeff Bezos, you know, enforced that idea within Amazon about, was it 11, 12 years ago, I think he unwittingly set the stage for all things to be API driven and all connectivity to be API driven, which is fantastic because it really makes programming a lot easier. I'll just pass you something, some data, some JSON, some payloads. I get something back and I don't have to worry about that part of my code working or not working anymore. You know, it's based on a guarantee. It's based on a spec that's been published. And it's even a little bit cleaner than it's like a standard SDK because those APIs are always live. I can always test against it.
And again, that's, I think, why, you know, it's what 67% of the market, right, in terms of like, or higher in terms of like, are using Amazon service exactly for that. You can scale these things using the APIs. You can build more services. You can grow your services as a company. I mean, as a developer, you know, we didn't have these things like, you know, like starting out. It was like, you know, PCF helped get us to the mid ground, and then having these APIs and these other services like Kubernetes and all these, you know, help to do this.
Learn how to operationalize Open Policy Agent at scale with Styra. To get started, go to the link at https://hubs.ly/h0pnkm20.
Teleport allows engineers and security professionals to unify access for SSH servers, Kubernetes clusters, web applications, and databases across all environments. You can download Teleport right now at goteleport.com. That's GOTELEPORT.com.
So I'm going to ask you the last question. And the question is what work in your career are you most proud of?
That's a tough one. I think every subsequent job I have had has had more responsibility with a more visible product and a more visible company. So I would say, you know, every job I've had, I'm more proud than the previous one. And a part of that has to be attributed to the people who've helped me get here. So I think a lot of thanks to those who, you know, will probably remain unnamed on this podcast, who've mentored me, who've given me the opportunity, who've been, who've leaned in, provided feedback, good and bad. That's really important for personal growth and personal development, but it's also the opportunities to actually step into the role. And I remember Paul Moritz said something when we first started Pivotal. He said, look around. For every person who's here, there's probably 1,000 people in the world who would love to have your job, but you're the person in this role right now. So make the most of it, right? Do the work, do the hard work, challenge yourself, because you don't get this opportunity frequently. And it's true. He was absolutely right. You don't get to, you know, very few of us ever get to actually be in a company that IPOs, let alone do that twice in one career. That's kind of crazy. So knock on wouldn't be grateful and thankful. I think the other question.
Congrats on GitLab's IPO. Congrats on that again.
Yeah, great, but I'm like, great company. What an amazing journey.
It's a great journey, but also I got a lot of friends over there, like Mel Smolensky and Brett and now you, right? It's just like, it's such a wonderful, you want the good people to win. And when I saw that, I'm like, the good people won. I was so proud of you all for that.
It's nice to be rewarded for your hard work. And certainly it's a nice, you know, bauble to put on your shelf, but I think you only celebrate for those 5 minutes. And you pat yourself on the back, you've earned it. But again, recognize that the work isn't done, right? An IPO is really, you're the third mile of a marathon. We've got a lot more work to do. We don't rest on our laurels. We actually double down and work even harder. The one question I think you asked in the beginning is kind of how do you get into the alliances is the one I'm really curious. And I want to end with that one. There's no right answer, to be honest with you, right? You can kind of hear just speaking with me, I've got a little bit of technical savvy. I've got a little bit of product savvy. I've got a little bit of like legal savvy or sales savvy. I have seen people within alliances come from all walks of life. Like even on our team, we have folks who have a sales background, people have an engineering background, those who've come from a pure marketing background, and then others who've just actually weren't born in technology, didn't start in technology or cloud. They had a completely different career path and somehow have ended up here. And they have taken on that mantle of responsibility and said, I'm going to lean in, I'm going to learn, and I'll do the things that need to be done for me to be able to build this capability within myself. And they may short time it within alliances, or this may become, you know, ultimately a career path for people. I work with colleagues that have been in their specific area of expertise for 26 years and more. And I also work with colleagues for whom this might be their fourth career, right? All of these people bring something very important to the table. And what makes a great alliance person is the person who really wants to be there, right? Don't inherit the job, take the job, you know, lean in hard. There's no gospel that we can follow. There's no stone tablets, there's no, rule sets that you can follow. It's completely unwritten. And I think if you want to be successful, the trick is to lean in, the trick is to listen, like be open to learning, find people who are smarter than you, who've got more experience than you, and see if they're willing to mentor you. An hour a year is enough. Having someone who's super experienced just tell you what you can do. It's the meta knowledge. You don't know what you don't know. You really don't know your own potential until someone pushes you in that direction. And then you challenge yourself to meet those milestones and then exceed them. All these are great. I have never met anyone in alliances who has been unable to build on their past to become better at the job that they have, right? So if you're good at sales, use that as your strong muscle and then work on where you're weak. If you're great as a technical person, start there. and then build out your sales muscle, but do the things that are very uncomfortable to you, but definitely try your hand out. You know, we live in a culture of we have heroes, right? We want people to win. We don't appreciate the level of investment it takes to get to that point. And when my son was, you know, playing Little League in baseball, it took a while for him to understand baseball is a failure sport. Now, every 2 out of 3 times you get up on the plate,
you're considered a success at a 300, yeah. You know, right?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And so you're going to be disappointed. You're going to drop the ball. You're going to miss the base. Something's going to happen. More often than you're going to make mistakes than you're going to have more losses than wins. That's just the nature of the game. But I think every one of those is a learning experience. Winning is a learning experience. Failure is a learning experience. And you have to treat it that way. If you make the same mistake twice, shame on you. But if you've made the mistake and learned from it and can share that learning, that is huge. And we really talked about just grow that, build that. The last piece I'll leave you with is, you know, when you watch sports and they do that kind of interview with the coaches, I love watching the coaches that don't necessarily debug themselves, like what went wrong with your team today, who didn't play well, but elevate what the other team did well. Like, I recognize that coach so-and-so did this play or the linebacker ran this particular out, or, you know, the quarterback was really able to be situationally aware and step out of the pocket. Right. That is really important to be able to recognize excellence in others and understand what you can learn from it, because your own experiences are going to be super limited. And you're only going to be able to see a couple of colors within the rainbow, but to see all the colors, all the potential, it's really important to pay attention to what other people are doing. And this is where your network is really important. This is where you have to invest the time to reach out to people, have phone calls, Zoom with them, go grab a drink, dinner, socialize with them. Like, part of our role is being hypersocial. It's super uncomfortable for those of us who are introverted extroverts. Sure. You get to come back home, recharge, go back out again. But I think it's super important because that network gives you information that you don't normally have. You can't research on Google. It's not available in your email. There's nobody on Slack you can ask. And you don't even have the experience. But to build out your network is super critical within an alliance organization, because they will help you think through your problems in a way that you haven't thought before. And I do this all the time. If I'm trying to do something new that's untested, different, or I haven't done it before, there's a huge network of people I can reach out to and ask them, hey, have you ever done this before? How did it work out for you? What should I watch out for? What are the mistakes I'm going to make that I should just at least be self-aware? And overall, I think that will serve you well in how well you can do within an alliance's organization. And then at the end of the day, yeah, sometimes you got bad days, but you also have good days. So celebrate those as well.
So you all, again, you got an education from one of the best in the biz in terms of technical alliances. He's seen it all. He's done it all. This has been one of my favorite episodes this season, Nima. Thank you so much for what, you know, again, just providing this. Let me speak a little Farsi to my friend here. Merci for everything. I appreciate it. And hopefully at some point we'll get out to Los Angeles again and we'll maybe have some Cuba Day or maybe some Tadik or something like this.
I like that. Any chance to go out and eat and celebrate would be fine by me.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Nima.
And it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.